Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, Labor Relations Information Systems podcast on recent developments in the public safety workplace. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next hour or so as we cover recent cases and other things that are happening that are of interest to firefighters, police officers, corrections officers, and everybody who is a public safety employee. I've got this month, five cases that I want to talk about. But before I get into the cases, we're sitting on the cusp of the one version or another of the tax bills passing in the United States Congress. It looks, as I'm recording this, looks very much like either the Republican they're both Republican versions, either the Senate or the House versions, the tax bill are going to pass. And the question is, what's going to be changed as it heads to President Trump, who's vowed to sign whatever it is Congress comes up with. Now, I know there's a lot of stuff in these tax bills, a lot of stuff that doesn't have anything to do with taxes. It's now being referred to as a Christmas tree kind of bill. So, for example, there's a lifting of the 60-year-old ban on political activism by churches. And one of the bills, the House bills, creates a new legal right for fetuses. Those are on the wish list of the evangelical groups, but they really don't have anything to do with taxes or tax relief. What I want to focus on are the provisions of the bill that will impact people in the public safety workplace. And there are a few that I've been able to identify. Now, there may be more. Part of the problem with this bill is how rushed it is, right? You've, I'm sure, seen the pictures of senators who were given a 457-page bill, I think it was, and they were given this bill to read less than an hour before they voted on it. And you've seen, I'm sure, images of the fact that parts of the bill, there was actually hand scribbling that changed certain aspects of the bill. And I think it's safe to say that very few people in this country, including me, have any idea about everything that are in these bills. But these seem to be the major features that are going to impact people in the public sector. The first is there's going to be a change in the way local taxes are treated under federal tax law. The bills would completely eliminate deductions for state and local income and sales taxes. Now, under many circumstances, you can deduct off your federal taxes what you pay for particular state and local income taxes, and in some rare cases, sales taxes. Also, right now, you can deduct whatever you pay for property taxes. That is likely to be capped under these bills at $10,000. What's going to be the impact of all that? It is going to squeeze state and local revenues because it's going to be more expensive for the citizens of those states to pay, for example, a $15,000, if that's what it is, a property tax bill. The result is going to be that, and this is a prediction that is widely made by those on all sides of the political spectrum, the result is going to be that taxes are going to be a tremendous pressure for state and local taxes to be lowered. And if you lower those taxes, public safety, at least in terms of cities and counties, is by far the biggest share of budgets. You're going to see budget pressure on public safety agencies. So that's one impact that's out there. I haven't seen any numbers associated with that yet. I'm sure we'll see predictions as we get towards a final bill and one passes and then we figure out what it is everybody did. The second area of impact concerns health insurance. The bills end what's known as the individual mandate under the Affordable Care Act. What's that mean? 13 million people will lose their health insurance. And what's that mean? I've been through this before on these podcasts. Because you have those people being uninsured doesn't mean they're not going to get medical care. They're going to go right back to what it is they did before you had the individual mandate, and that is they're going to get their health care from hospitals and emergency rooms, just about the most expensive place you can get health care. The result, an increase in medical costs for everybody else. And what is that increase in medical costs likely to be? Well, we have two estimates that are out there. There's the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office that has done an estimate. And there's also what's known as the Joint Committee on Taxation. That is a joint House-Senate committee that looks at the impacts of tax bills. And the CBO and the Joint Committee come up with the same number. Health insurance costs are likely to rise over the next few years by 10%, independent of any changes in utilization or independent of any changes in what the goods and services actually cost. In other words, this tax bill, in and of itself, will cause a 10% rise in medical costs. And as you see that, of course, you're going to see more pressure at the collective bargaining table over who's going to pay for this increase in medical costs. And you are also going to see impacts on what's known as the Cadillac tax. Because if you have higher medical costs, you're going to be closer to those Cadillac tax thresholds. And neither of these bills does anything with the Cadillac tax for high-cost health and insurance plans. One other area that seems clear to have an impact is that because this tax bill adds money to the deficit, the current estimates are that this tax bill will add $1.5 trillion to the deficit, and that $1.5 trillion gets reduced to about $1 trillion if all of the assumptions that those pushing the bill are putting out there about how much this is going to spur growth, if all those assumptions are true, instead of $1.5 trillion, we only add $1 trillion to the deficit. So what we're doing with this bill is we are financing tax relief by adding to the national debt, either $1.5 trillion or $1 trillion. I'll let the economists debate which one it is going to be. I will tell you that in the last couple of days, the University of Chicago did a survey of 38 leading economists, and these were economists all over the political spectrum, as to whether or not the growth assumptions in the tax bill, whether or not those are likely to come true, meaning we'll get down to $1 trillion rather than $1.5 trillion. And of the 38 economists, 37 said no, that this tax bill is not going to spur any sort of growth. But who knows? You know, we're flying in the dark here. Okay, back to the point that I was making before I digressed. When you add that much money to the deficit under existing laws, it's going to trigger automatic cuts in various federal programs. Now, one of them is a general one, and that is Medicare. This will trigger automatic Medicare cuts, meaning we'll have yet more uninsured individuals, meaning we'll have yet more of a rise in the cost of medicine and healthcare. We don't know how much yet. Nobody is, I haven't seen any numbers associated with it, but everybody seems to be in agreement that this is going, adding this much to the deficit will trigger these automatic cuts. There will also be automatic cuts in various federal programs. One of them that will see cuts will be the Public Safety Officers Benefits Program. This is the program that provides benefits for the families of public safety employees who have been killed while responding to emergencies. Again, we don't know how much in the way of cuts. The number I've seen is $10 million, but it could be more or less than that. We don't know. There will be much more substantial cuts in the crime victims fund. The number I've seen there is in excess of $100 million. And all of this will be the feature of automatic triggers. This is not going to have to be anything Congress debates or not. Okay, so where does all this tax relief go? Because public safety employees are generally considered to be middle class wage earners. So are they going to benefit by getting a reduction in their taxes? It appears the answer to that question is no. Once again, I'm going to refer to the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation. And their estimates are that over the next 10 years, individuals making $40,000 to $50,000 a year actually would pay more money under this tax plan. They'd pay a combined $5 billion more. The group of people who earn $1 million or more per year actually get the tax cut. They get a tax cut of $5.8 billion. What you really have going on here is middle-class people paying for the tax cut for those who earn $1 million or more. And another way of looking at it, and this comes from an outfit called the Tax Policy Center, is that over the next 10 years, 98% of those earning $1 million or more would get a tax cut. Those earning $75,000 or less, just 27% of them would get a tax cut. At any rate, this is just really a shot across the bow from me, letting you know that there are some public safety workplace implications to this tax bill. And thus far, all of them that I am seeing indicate tighter budgets in public sector in general and public safety in particular. Okay, let's turn to something that is a little clearer, court opinions. At least, you know, you can read all of those. They're not 457 pages long, thank goodness, or I'd probably be in a different line of work, to tell you the truth. I want to talk about an issue that comes up with some frequency, and that is what happens when an employer overpays an employee and wants to get the money back. Let's call this recouping overpayments. How does this happen? I'll tell you where it most commonly happens is when an employer changes its electronic payroll system. When it changes the software it uses to pay employees. It could be just a change in the payroll aspect of the software. Sometimes it can be an employer going to an entirely new software system that manages things like a budget and projects and property that's owned by a municipality or a county, and it has a payroll element. When you see these changes, that's when you tend to see a collection of overpayments. You also see a collection of underpayments. I think I probably speak for everybody who's been involved in these issues before on any side of the table when I say that the least favored thing we have to deal with in a labor relations setting are when the words, "we're going to a new payroll system," are uttered. You just know that disasters are going to result. Too many times you see employers take these new payroll systems and try to force past practices into the new payroll systems rather than adapt the payroll systems for the existing practices. The result are grievances and lawsuits and underpayments and overpayments, and it's generally a mess. I've used the analogy for many years in dealing with these issues that there really ought to be a plaque hanging over the door of every city and county and state payroll department in this country. And that plaque should be borrowed from the sign that is over the door to hell in Dante's Inferno. Remember what that was? Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Because it seems when you get with these situations where an employer's changing payroll systems, the predominant answer is, it can't be done. Well, that's what gives us litigation, and, you know, I guess to some extent, that's what makes people like me, lawyers, happy. Not really, actually. Okay, so what are the rules about employers recouping overpayments? How do you figure this all out? Well, think of this as a triaging issue. First, you need to ask, what's federal law say? Second, you need to ask, what does state law say? And then third, you need to ask, what do I need to do in a collective bargaining environment? So first of all, federal law, what does that say? And let's assume the employer has really, truly overpaid the employee, wants its money back, and wants to get the money back through deductions from the employee's ongoing pay. What does federal law say? Essentially, nothing. About the only outside constraint on an employer's ability to recoup overpayments would be the Fair Labor Standards Act. Because, of course, the FLSA has a minimum wage. You couldn't recoup so much that the employee fell below the minimum wage. And the FLSA has overtime obligations as well, that theoretically, I guess, would be based on the minimum wage. Haven't seen that case yet. But federal law, in general, just doesn't say a whole lot about this. What about state law? Well, state laws vary a lot. And they do say quite a bit. There are some, to be sure, states that have no statutes dealing with recoupment of overpayments. There are some that actually line out with a great deal of specificity what it is an employer may do to recoup an overpayment. We're going to be dealing with a Washington law when I talk about the case that spurs this discussion. We're going to be dealing with a Washington statute that has some really specific requirements as to what an employer can and cannot do. And some states have laws that prohibit an employer from taking unilateral action. Up in Alaska, for example, that's the way the state's wage and hour law is written, meaning if the employer wants to recoup overpayments, it's got to go to court, got to sue the employee. It can't do the self-help thing by making some sort of deductions from the employee's paycheck. So second level of the triaging for you, check what your state law is. Third, assume you get beyond federal and state law, and you're in a collective bargaining environment, you need to check what your collective bargaining rules are. It may be that you bargained over this. It may be that there's a clause in your collective bargaining agreement governing overpayments. For example, my home city of Portland, Oregon, the police union contract in Portland has a very specific clause that says essentially that if there's a demonstrable overpayment, the employer and the employee sit down with the union and they negotiate what the repayment schedule will be, but it can't be any faster than the mistake was made. So if you have an overpayment that occurred over the course of 13 pay periods, you can't recover it any faster than 13 pay periods. That's an example of a collective bargaining agreement. But what if you're in a collective bargaining environment and you don't have a clause in your collective bargaining agreement? What about overpayments then? That's where we get to our case. This case involves Benton County, Washington. And the corrections officers in Benton County are represented by a Teamsters local. It's local 839. In November of 2016, the auditor's office in Benton County discovered that there'd been an accounting software error. abandon all hope, ye who enter here. An accounting software error that had caused the county to overpay 85 corrections officers through all pay periods in June through September of 2016. We don't need to get into the details of what the mistake was, what the coding was. If you care, it was a particular pay code that was described as Kelly time used. But the net effect is it caused an improper increase in compensation. Now, there's a Washington state law that governs recovering overpayments. And under this state law, the employer is allowed to recoup overpayments through wage deductions, but those deductions can't exceed more than 5% of the employee's disposable earnings in any pay period. The county sent a letter to all of its employees, didn't CC the union on this. By the way, memo to employers, if you are sending something out to all employees about taking money out of their paychecks, good idea to CC the union. Anyway, the employer didn't do so here, and the county said to employees, look, we're going to give you three options here as to how we're going to get this money out of your paychecks, how we're going to claw back the overpayments. First, you can agree to deduct the full overpayment amount from your next paycheck. Second, we'll agree that we can deduct an amount that we all agree upon, something you specify. If we think it's reasonable, we'll agree on that amount. And third, our fallback position is state law. We're going to deduct an amount that won't exceed 5% of the employee's disposable earnings. The county's letter said, if you don't respond within 20 days, we're going to begin withholding the 5% level. The local, of course, Teamsters local, finds out about this, finds out about it pretty quickly, and sends the county a demand to bargain over the issue. Now, let's pause for a moment, because I'm going to be critical of what it is Local 839 did here. To be sure, it should have sent a demand to bargain, because this concerns wages, and wages are typically mandatorily negotiable. I'll get to the holding in the case on that in just a moment. To be sure, it should have sent a demand to bargain. But what else is going on here? When the county is sending a letter to individual employees saying, we want to take some money out of your paychecks. Well, I hope for most of you, the phrase direct dealing or the phrase yellow dog contract sprang to mind. Remember, if something's a mandatory subject of bargaining, the agreement concerning it must involve the union. The employer can't go out there on a one-on-one basis and negotiate individual contracts with bargaining unit members about a mandatory subject of bargaining. That's direct dealing. But apparently, in this case, Local 839's letter didn't protest the direct dealing. So instead, we're left with a plain old vanilla demand to bargain. How does the county respond to the demand to bargain? It says, we're not able to. That's the auditor's business. That's not ours. We're not able to negotiate or bargain the authority of the auditor's office and their statutory responsibility for recouping overpayments. Let me pause again. Is there such a thing as an exception to the obligation to bargain if a decision is made by another arm of the employer, such as the auditor? Prediction, this isn't going to come out well for the county. Well, after a period of time passes with Local 839 saying we want to bargain and the county saying we can't, our hands are tied, it's the auditor's job, in January 2017, the county begins deducting from the wages of employees to account for the overpayment. Local 839 files an unfair labor practice complaint with Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission, and game on. It initially, the case initially goes to a hearing officer with PERC, and the hearing officer finds that the county has committed an unfair labor practice. So I want to take apart this hearing officer's decision just a little bit, not a lot. But here's the way the hearing officer looks at it. The hearing officer says, yeah, county, you're right. You have an interest in collecting repayment for wage overpayments. We'll even concede, for the purposes of this opinion, that you have an obligation to recoup those overpayments. You have a statutory obligation to recoup the overpayments. But that doesn't eliminate your bargaining obligation, because your interest in recoupment isn't the same thing as deciding how the repayment is to be made. There are many ways to have this recoupment happen. And we know that because we've seen three of them in the county's letter to all these employees. Does this change, does this method or these options for recoupment concern mandatory subjects of bargaining? Sure, says the hearing officer, quoting, employees have a strong interest in subjects related to wages, and the county's decision is directly related to wages because it concerns implementing deductions and accrued leave cash outs to recover money that employees originally received as wages. So, county, you've made a unilateral change in a mandatory subject of bargaining. You've done it without negotiating. That's an unfair labor practice. So what's the remedy? What does the hearing officer say? It's a pretty fascinating remedy that he comes up with. He says, to begin with, we know the remedy in these cases. You have to restore, the Latin phrase is status quo ante. You have to put everybody back the way they were before the change is made. And in this case, that would mean the county would have to repay the recoupment of the overpayments plus interest. But again, the hearing officer says, you know what, there may well be this statutory obligation for employees to pay back the money. So you know what the best remedy here is? It'll be up to the union to determine how the repayment occurs. And the county is going to have to post, of course, that it committed an unfair labor practice. I know I spent a bit of time on this whole issue, and I only spend it that much time because this is an issue that really does pop up with a lot of frequency, and I think it's important that everybody have at least a general background on what the rules are when you have a recoupment. All right, I want to move now to a disciplinary issue. I want to talk about a case you may have seen something about in the paper. You know, of course, that the Chicago Police Department has been the subject of a Department of Justice investigation as to whether police practices violated civil rights. There's all sorts of political posturing going on over the Department of Justice's initial report. Because, of course, since the report came out, we've had a presidential election. The new Department of Justice under Attorney General Sessions is uninterested in pursuing consent decrees of this sort. The state attorney general in Illinois then filed a lawsuit against the city, trying to make the argument that a state civil rights statute enabled the enforcement of the federal typical civil rights remedies. That lawsuit is pending. The mayor of the city of Chicago has his own position. Then there are the equivalent of the Chicago City Council. It has a different name, where you have different council members who are staking out different positions. I mean, it's just a horrible political mess. But in the middle of that, the police department has unilaterally implemented changes in its disciplinary system, and in particular, it has created a disciplinary matrix. So what's a disciplinary matrix? A disciplinary matrix is a big table And in this case, the table is 47 pages long. And if you can just create a mental picture of this, on the left side of the table is going to be whatever the disciplinary offenses are. And on the right side of the table will be what the standard punishment is for engaging in those disciplinary offenses. That's usually the structure of these disciplinary matrices. As I've mentioned in a prior podcast, these disciplinary, I want to call them matrices, which I think is technically correct, although it's hard to say that word, but I'll use it. These disciplinary matrices have gone in and out of favor around the country. There was a big push for them in the 1990s. I think it really started in the Houston Police Department, kind of spread around the country. They're in use in a lot of larger cities and counties around the country. And in the last few years, employers have started to move away from them. And they started to move away from them because they're concerned that the matrices actually tie their hands in particular disciplinary cases. So there's been a push and pull over these things over the years. So what's going on in Chicago? In Chicago, there's different investigatory routes that are taken depending upon the seriousness of the allegation against the officer. The more serious disciplinary charges are investigated through what's known as a complaint register process. That term's going to become important here. Under the complaint register process, the city's independent police review authority reviews allegations of misconduct made against members of the department by the public. It retains investigatory authority over some categories of misconduct, but also can transfer investigations of other categories of misconduct to the department's Bureau of Internal Affairs, which in turn can delegate the investigation down to the police district where the complaint originated. So that's the complaint register process. Prior to 2017, the Chicago Police Department used an informal process to assess penalties at the conclusion of the complaint register investigation process. The investigators would come up with a recommended penalty that would be based on historical penalties for similar instances of misconduct. The recommended penalty would take into account arbitration decisions or police board decisions or court decisions. So that was the system before February 1, 2017. On February 1, 2017, the department changed all that and moved to what's known as a complaint register matrix and guidelines. This is that 47-page document. The matrix is essentially a table that establishes penalties and penalty ranges that attach to different rule violations, and the guidelines explain how the department uses the matrix. Editorial comment for just a moment. If you have a department rule or guidelines that is 47 pages long, it's too long. These documents, particularly ones that are concerned with the disciplinary process, have to be readily understandable by those who are subject to them and those who enforce them. You can't be leafing through a 47-page document to figure out where you should be in that document. Okay, editorial comment done. So the development of this complaint register matrix actually dovetailed with that Department of Justice investigation that I was describing. The complaint register, as I mentioned, was implemented on February 1 of 2017. The DOJ issued its report on January 13th, 2017. The DOJ found that the department had what it referred to as a deficient accountability system with respect to that led to, again, the DOJ's word, the department's pattern and practice of unconstitutional conduct. The DOJ did note that the department was developing this matrix and applauded it, described the matrix as, and I'm quoting again, an important step towards providing greater consistency and clarity in discipline for officer misconduct. So you have the DOJ report that signals that the complaint register matrix is going to be issued. 2 weeks later, the complaint register matrix is issued, and it is done unilaterally by the department. The union that represents rank-and-file police officers in Chicago is Lodge 7 of the Fraternal Order of Police. It files an unfair labor practice, a complaint, with the Illinois Labor Relations Board, and says that the complaint says the unilateral implementation of the matrix violated the city's obligations to bargain under state law. This produces the decision from an administrative law judge that you may have read about in the papers. And the administrative law judge says, unfair labor practice. You got to bargain over changes in disciplinary standards. Because this comes up so often, I'm actually going to quote from about three or four sentences in this ALJ's opinion. The ALJ says, look, the city, through the matrix, changed the disciplinary consequences to employees for violating the city's rules, and it designated new penalty ranges for each category of rule violation. Here comes the key sentence. By design, the penalty ranges in this matrix do not reflect the penalties that the city historically applied for the identified rule violations. Hearing officer goes on to say, investigators don't look at the past practice under the complaint register matrix. They won't look at the past practice of discipline. They won't look at what arbitrators and courts and the police board have done. They'll instead just turn to page 35 of this document, and they will find whatever the penalty is. That's a change in the mandatorily negotiable topic of discipline. And those are the sorts of changes that have to be bargained. Not only that, the hearing officer says, you've changed the procedures that are applied to discipline. You've done that because you have placed new restrictions on the discretion of the investigators who do these investigations and make recommendations of discipline. And I'm returning to the hearing officer's opinion now. He said, absent mitigating or aggravating factors, sergeants and investigators must recommend a penalty within the presumptive range contained in the matrix. And members of management who review these penalties don't have discretion to modify them anymore. That's a change in disciplinary procedures, and that too is mandatory for collective bargaining. So, what's the remedy in this case? Same as in that recoupment of overpayments case. The ALJ orders the city restore the status quo. What does that mean? Get rid of that matrix and guidelines pending any bargaining, and you rescind any disciplinary action that the city imposed using the matrix and guidelines. You're going to have to make members whole for any losses they've suffered, together with interest at the rate of 7%. So, once again, this is, I don't think, an earth-shaking decision, because we've seen these decisions a number of times, but changes in disciplinary standards and changes in disciplinary procedures are mandatory for bargaining. I want to turn to another disciplinary case. This one's out in Maryland, and it involves Maryland's Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. It's a statutory Bill of Rights. Maryland is one of, by my count, 17 states that have a police officer's Bill of Rights. There are several states, not nearly as many, that have a firefighter Bill of Rights. And this case, I'll tell you, I've got my eyebrows raised when I read this opinion, and I have to wonder whether or not we're hearing the last word on this, because it seems like an unusual result. But this case involves a provision, very standard provision, in a Bill of Rights that says, now I'm going to quote from the Maryland statute, an investigation or interrogation of a law enforcement officer that results in recommendation of an action that is considered punitive vests with the officer the right to a hearing before a hearing board before the disciplinary action is final. This is, as I say, a very standard provision in a peace officer's, public safety officer's Bill of Rights. If there is going to be punitive action, there has to be a hearing before the punitive action is finalized. So what's this Maryland case all about? It's about the question of what is punitive. This is a case that involves Officer Jason Thomas of the Annapolis Police Department. Thomas sustains an injury in the line of duty. It requires surgery on his knee. He applies for disability retirement, which the city denies, and Thomas appeals. So he's got this disability application over there on one track. He's saying he's disabled. The city is disputing it, and that's going through the disability system. Over a year later, Thomas, who's been on light duty work, transitions back to full duty police work. That lasts a few hours, because on the same day he returns to work, he reports that he has re-injured his knee while entering his squad car, and the department places him on light duty again. At this point, the police department management has had about enough of this situation. They have a conference call. They talk about Thomas's status. They discuss that independent medical examinations revealed that he could do full-duty work. They talked about the possibility of terminating him, but instead what they did was to offer him a position as a records specialist. That's a full-time clerical job. It would have been at a lower pay grade, but it would have kept Thomas with a job. He declines, and the department eventually fires him. But something happens before it fires him. That disability retirement appeal gets decided. It gets decided by something known as the Public Safety Disability Retirement Board of the City of Annapolis, and it finds that Thomas is not disabled. After the board reaches its decision, Thomas makes no effort to contact the department to discuss returning to work. He turns down the offer of the record specialist job, and the chief terminates Thomas. And he does so through a letter indicating that Thomas's, I'm quoting, unwillingness to return to work as a police officer under these circumstances constitutes unsatisfactory work performance and warrants termination. But something doesn't happen. The hearing under the Bill of Rights doesn't happen. Thomas sues, said, and his lawsuit says, my termination is punitive, and I should have received a hearing before the decision was made. Thomas also said he was subject to an interrogation when the department asked him whether and when he could return to work. And what's known as the Maryland Court of Special Appeals disagrees with him and upholds his termination. As to the interrogation issue, the court says routine and periodic evaluations of an officer's work performance, they're not an investigation under the Bill of Rights, even when the officer's performance is being compared to that of colleagues. An inquiry into medical status, that's not an investigation or an interrogation. And even though there was this discussion with Thomas about his light duty status and his physical recovery, that's all part of the sort of routine review of an officer's status that the department has the right to do without triggering the Bill of Rights. Now, here comes the part that I raise my eyebrows at. I think the first part is actually pretty routine. I'd expect to see that decision under a Bill of Rights. You just can't be operating a public safety agency where every single routine supervisory subordinate inquiry is subject to the Bill of Rights. And lots of cases say that. That part's not controversial. But here comes the other part. And I'm going to start just by quoting from the court's opinion. Even if we were to conclude that the department conducted an investigation of Thomas, we are not persuaded that Thomas's dismissal from the department in and of itself constitutes a punitive action. Not every dismissal of a police officer is punitive. As you might imagine, Thomas is saying at about this point when he's reading this opinion, what do you mean not every dismissal of a police officer is punitive? This feels awful punitive to me. I just got fired. Well, what does the court say? How does the court answer that question? The court says, when officers fail to meet the expectations of their position or demonstrate continued unsatisfactory performance, the Bill of Rights doesn't limit the chief's authority to make personnel adjustments, including termination when that will best serve the department. Dismissals under those circumstances are not punitive. Whoa, think about this for a moment. Let me go back to that phrase. When officers fail to meet the expectations of their position or demonstrate continued unsatisfactory performance, that isn't a punitive action when an employer fires a law enforcement officer for demonstrating continuing unsatisfactory performance. Isn't that an exception? Call it a loophole, if you will, through which you could drive a truck. This is why I'm thinking we may not have seen the last word on this case. I mean, you never know whether Thomas will appeal. You never know whether the higher court in Maryland, which is known as the Court of Appeals, not the Special Court of Appeals, you never know whether that court will take the case. But this certainly seems like a bit of an unusual decision. But that's the way it came out, and that's where it stands for now under the Maryland Bill of Rights. Last case I want to talk about is a kind of interesting, what I think of as a Garrity Plus case that comes out of Michigan. So let me get into the facts first, and then I'll pose for you what the legal issue is and kind of the interesting result that the court reaches. So this is a case involving a trooper, Michigan State Police trooper by the name of Craig Zychina. And I apologize to Trooper Zychina for undoubtedly mispronouncing his name. Zychina is a member of what's known as the Home Security Team. And on December 23rd and 24th, 2014, the team executes a couple of search warrants in Leoni Township, Michigan. Shortly afterwards, there's a complaint, and the state police begins to investigate whether or not the theft of personal property had occurred by somebody who was on that team during the exercise of the warrants. During the investigation, the state police sends Zychina this notice, and it's important that you hear the exact words of this notice. This correspondence is to inform you that you will be interviewed as a principal concerning allegations of criminal misconduct. This investigation could result in criminal and/or disciplinary actions against you. Any self-incriminating statements you make pertaining to these allegations may be used against you in both criminal and or disciplinary proceedings. So think about that wording. I find it very confusing, right? It's this mixture of a kind of sort of Garrity warning with a kind of sort of Miranda warning. It's hard to tell. This correspondence is to inform you that you will be interviewed. Will is a mandatory word. The investigation could result in criminal and / or disciplinary action. Are we criminal? Miranda? Are we disciplinary? Garrity? It's not clear. It's and or. I find this statement to be really troublesome in the way it is crafted. Zaychina gets it. He, of course, hires a lawyer, and he provides a written statement in lieu of attending an in-person interview. He later calls up and says, hey, I would like to do an in-person interview. And he makes statements in that in-person interview that contradict the prior written statement. The result? Criminal charges. He's charged with lying to a peace officer during a criminal investigation. And apparently there's a Michigan statute that criminalizes willful neglect of duty, because Zaychina is charged with that as well. He, as you might expect, files a motion to suppress all of the statements, written or oral, that he made to the investigating officers. And he argues that those statements were involuntary under a Michigan state statute. So this isn't a Garrity case. This is why I called it a Garrity plus case when I started this discussion. This is a case under a statute that gives more protections than Garrity, but looks and behaves a lot like Garrity. Zaychina makes this motion to suppress his statements. Trial court grants the motion, and the matter ends up before the Michigan Court of Appeals, which upholds the trial court's order and holds that the statements should be suppressed. Why? What's this statute say? And the court says, here's the important phrase in the statute. An involuntary statement made by a law enforcement officer shall not be used against the law enforcement officer in a criminal proceeding. So what's an involuntary statement? The law says, the statute says, an involuntary statement is information provided by an officer if compelled under threat of dismissal from employment or any other employment sanction, if it's compelled by the law enforcement agency that employs the officer. So an involuntary statement that's off limits, can't be used in any criminal proceeding, is information that is compelled under threat of dismissal or any other sanction. What the court says is that this law protects both true and false statements. The court says if we were to hold otherwise, we would defeat the legislature's intent to preclude the use of any information. Well, but was Zaychina compelled? The court says Zaychina was not asked to participate in an interview. He was told, you will be interviewed. The court says, and here's a quote, even viewed objectively, looking past Zaychina's subjective perception of a threat to his employment, this notice from one's employer would cause a reasonable person to believe that he or she must actively participate in an interview in order to avoid adverse employment context. The court goes on to say, the plain language of this law protects all statements given by officers under compulsion, whether true or not. The court does offer a bit of an aside here. It says, this choice may seem odd or reflective of questionable or even bad public policy, but it was the legislature's choice to make. were not empowered to displace what the law actually provides with a judicial preference for what we believe it should provide. So the court ends up holding that this statement, Zaychina's, both his oral and his written statements, need to be suppressed, even in the context of what is essentially a perjury prosecution. This may be what the eventual difference is between Garrity and a Garrity plus statute like this. Under Garrity, there are courts that have held that there is an exception to using a compelled statement that allow an employee to be prosecuted for perjury that occurs during the course of a compelled statement. Garrity isn't a bar to that. There's even a case that says Garrity isn't a bar to prosecution for obstruction of justice when the obstruction of justice lies with an untruthful statement that was made in a compelled interview. This Michigan statute, Garrity Plus, eliminates that exception. It says you can't use it, whether that statement's true or false, whether it was intentionally perjurious or not. You can't use it. Okay, that's it for this edition of First Thursday. I'd like to welcome you to join us in the start of, can't believe I'm saying this, 2018 for the next edition of First Thursday. Our next seminar is in February in, of course, Las Vegas, and that's where we'll be holding our seminar on public safety union leadership, talking basically about best practices for how you run fire, police, or corrections union, everything from constitution and bylaws to how you investigate disciplinary cases to fundraising to political activities. We hope that you join us at that seminar. And for now, with best wishes for the holiday season, this is Will Aitchison signing off.